bring in more subjects. Like, if you can pull the subjects and have interesting conversation about food, about our exploration of the food culture, of wine, of barbecue, of all
whatever
these
it
kind
is.
Of culinary things.
Yeah, that's true.
You go more in depth with it, you know? And that's what you're shooting for.
But, I mean, at the end of the day, how many levels could you go down with food?
You can go so far.
Food really?
Is culture. Food is culture.
I like where this is going. Yeah. Go down the rabbit hole. What would you say? So it's culture, but at the end, so we talking about like how France has influenced food to a degree, or are you saying?
So my base is classical French cooking.
Really?
Because that's the base for culinary schools around the world that are trying to say they're the best. And that influences everyone. Because they were searching for things to improve every single thing they could do. So you create standards, and that's what they did. Right?
That's nuts. I never thought of it that way.
So you create standards that is like, this is my standard of the quality that we're at. You have to meet us there. And if you have something better, that we're just going to grab that and make it a standard.
Huh.
And we're going to meet you. That's competition. And competition makes growth.
Well, I guess you can say the same thing within the barbecue industry. Like with in Austin, I mean, if you were to pull up Google Maps, it would be like, I mean, within a mile radius. What would you say, Russell?
Oh, man. Probably like within a mile radius, like 10, 15 barbecue restaurants. I have no idea.
At least, I mean, it's a lot.
Pulling that out of my ass.
You got trailers. You have restaurants.
Definitely.
Like brick and mortars.
Barbecue-rich area. Hill country. And that area is just in the soil.
I mean, the influence within the barbecue in itself. I mean, if we were to talk about the roots within barbecue, I mean, you have to go to the Carolinas and, like, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, with whole hog barbecue, with what they're doing at the end of the day, I mean, the Carolinas is, like, the only place I could think of that has both sauce, like, you have a tomato-based sauce, or you have a vinegar-based sauce.
And they got, like, mustard-based. They have, like, weird regions, like Western North Carolina has a sauce.
But would you have
there's
to agree that
ones.
The Carolinas is, like, the only place in the United States that could have, like, both sauces?
Yeah, maybe. I don't think I know enough about it.
I mean, personally, I don't know enough about it.
I don't know.
I mean, Rodney Scott, I mean, when he's doing whole barbecue, he has a vinegar-based sauce, but there could be somebody down the street from him that is doing a tomato base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. I don't know.
And like,
I think that the Carolinas, if you look at the history of the Carolinas, East Coast, it was a big port.
Huh.
So you have a lot of people from different nations and different cultures going in. And every culture has barbecue culture.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
If you look at it, it's pits, it's let's firewood, stuff like that, smoke coming up. But everybody does it a different way. And I think that America has grabbed it as like a national identity and really taken it to a different level. You know? And
man,
so like
Texas,
that
Texas
comes with
in particular.
Something that maybe, well, yeah, Texas, of course. But like Carolina has so much influence from different cultures. That you grab a little bit of everything, and regionally, it's going to be a little bit different,
mm-hmm.
which makes beauty. From there, you grow and you put things together, you know, and you make a whole new thing.
Mm-hmm.
Just
I do like the
a little something from somewhere and somewhere else.
The vinegar sauce is my personal or something strong with vinegar. I just think it cuts through the richness and. For example, barbecue sauce at Cooper's Barbecue. It's like a chain restaurant here in Texas. But, man, that sauce is so good. It's like a little bit buttery, but very acidic, very vinegary, a little bit oniony and garlicky. And
yeah, cut through that
They
fat.
Just dip whatever meat you get there, they just dunk it in there. And it's tasty. I don't know why more restaurants don't do that.
But I have to go there. I haven't gone there yet.
It's a little step back in time there.
You know, when I really, like, dive deep into barbecue, seeing how, you know, within Texas, the beef market, I mean, is huge. So, of course, you know, maybe back in the day, like, salt and pepper was, you know, and smoking the beef was probably the only thing that could, like, preserve that kind of protein, right? And how it evolved today with, like, just the different styles, like, just going from, you know, we're talking about the Carolinas with the whole hog, and we're talking about, you know, Texas with beef.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really very interesting at the end of the day to, you know, see, like, in the West Coast, like, I think I've even seen mutton over there, which is something that I'm like, who smokes that?
That's
like,
wild.
Who wants to eat mutton?
I think it's interesting how, like, smoking meats, that was, like, a form of preservation, but now it's an art form.
But so it's going also out of something, a like, form of preservation.
That's what,
yeah,
I,
yeah,
that's what I just
exactly
said.
No, but I'm saying it is also one. It's not only an art form.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
But you're literally looking at your product and you're like, this is great product. I have a great beef market here.
Mm-hmm.
Or I have a great pork market here. Let me grab what I can of the prime stuff and make it the best I can and preserve it. You know, make it last a longer time.
You know, another, I think, you know, preservation of meat is like dry aging.
Yes.
Seeing how kind of dry aged, like, you can get a dry aged steak at a very good steakhouse. It's, I mean, you basically quadrupled the dollar value amount of that steak being from raw, right? So you did like a 35-day aged steak or a 45-day aged steak, and being, you know, that sense of preservation, like, how long, I personally, I don't know how long you could age a protein. Like, what's the longest that you've maybe heard
of a
beef product being dry aged?
They can dry age for quite a while.
A long time,
I don't actually know the actual time period, but I'll tell you, when I was in New York, there was this butchery right next to where I was working, and we actually got some stuff from them. And they dry aged everything in-house.
In-house?
In-house. And it was the market, Chelsea Market. Very well known. But Chelsea Market, I remember, dude, carrying 200 pounds of beef, like 100 yards, just holding one edge. And I get one of my guys, Junior. His name is Junior. He's from Haitia. Didn't speak a lick of English. I'm like, Junior, avez-le-mi? You just speak like what you can. Like,
yeah.
French with him, I know very kitchen fundamental French.
Wow.
We go pick up 200 pounds of meat, and we carry it across, and we start just making that into burgers. But a lot of people don't have the taste of dry age. Dry age is grassier. It's like,
I've heard it's nuttier too.
Beefier,
right?
It's beefier, it's like, because there's less moisture in the meat. So
think
it's
about
a little
umami,
more intensified.
Yeah.
So when you dry something, you get umami out of it. Different flavors, and a lot of people are not used to that, and they don't get it.
Do you think that it's almost, when I see people like describe like the taste of a dry aged beef, they talk about how it's more nuttier. They talk about how it's more almost like a funky taste. Like,
it's definitely funky.
Yeah, like definitely. Like Chef Mike Perez, he did a pineapple like fish sauce and like fermented it.
Ooh, fermented fish with pineapple.
Yeah.
So you're getting some like old fish, amazing, like deep flavor, and you cut through it with some pineapple.
It was so good. It was so good. Like, I mean, it was literally days. I mean the vacuum sealed bag that it was in, it was totally like puffed up like a balloon. Like, yes. The thing was going to explode at any point. And what, I mean, it was just like tasting that flavor, like the funkiness, that you could taste the pineapple, like the pineapple really popped in flavor at the beginning, and it kind of mellowed out at the very end. You know, going back to dry age, it's kind of like, me personally, I haven't had a dry age steak, but just hearing people like describe it, you either love it or you hate it.
Yes, that's the thing.
You got to make sure you trim off that like oxidized, kind of gnarly looking layer. I think that helps with making it more palatable.
The bark.
Like, I don't know if it's a bark. It's just like a
no, because when you dry, it's like a crust. It's before you season or anything. You can see it. There's a crust.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Because dry aging, you're just pulling all the moisture out, and you're concentrating the flavor, you know? And so that's where, when you dry age, you have to expect, it's almost like making a blue cheese, if you think about it. You're bringing in all this funky bacteria in, but it's fine, because our bellies and our intestinal system is built to deal with that.
Mm.
Blue cheese, funky meat, like we built it to that. We're making it weaker every generation, but
yeah,
you know, we're refining our craft as well, so no worries, you know. But that's what dry aging is. You're inviting bacteria that's going to build, and it's going to add flavor.
Mm.
You can do it at home too. I mean, you can.
Yeah,
I think I saw an old Good Eats episode, which is Alton Brown's famous show, and he put a bunch of holes into like a pie tin and put the steak on top of that, and I think left it in the fridge for a couple days.
Yeah,
just let the moisture so drain like out of it. Age? I don't know.
Like a wet age?
I think it was dry age. It wasn't in any sort of
moist environment. What you're doing is you're pulling the moisture out. So you put it in a refrigerator, which is really a dehydrator. You take out the moisture. Remove bacteria.
Uncovered, so it's
uncovered, which is what I did with the chicken darker. I'm eating right now.
Yeah.
So like the chicken that I have cooking right now, I 3 days in the fridge, curing. You cure it. You put some salt and some. I like spices and stuff. So like salt and spices, sometimes sugar. I didn't put sugar. I didn't want sugar. But just like barbecue.
Yeah.
Right, and you pull out moisture and add flavor. Or you concentrate the flavor.
Yeah, like definitely one thing, like at Terry Black's, like being in Austin and being to experience that high volume and seeing, like for me, going from the backyard cooking maybe 4 or 5 briskets a year to then diving deep and all of a sudden we're doing 150 a day. You know, and just being able to see the process from trimming to seasoning to it sitting overnight to then being loaded onto a smoker. And I wouldn't say like quality control, but like the overall like premise of everything, like just going from you're trimming the brisket down to the right amount of fat. You're using the mustard lather. You're doing the kosher salt, the black pepper, the Lowry's. You're letting it sit overnight. It's getting loaded onto the pit. And it's like that all that salt and that pepper is drawing up enough moisture to where it's not only like tenderizing, but at the same time, it's pulling out enough moisture for the cook the next day to be a little bit easier. I would. I mean, for myself.
I don't know. I mean,
yeah, like you said, tenderizing.
Yeah.
You prepare the protein.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the salt is breaking down the small molecules inside the beef and making it easier to penetrate.
Mm.
You soften it.
Yeah. I'm just loving this conversation.
I think the seasoning ahead of time, though, helps. I can't prove it, but I think if you season the night before, it kind of helps with the bark formation. I don't know. I feel like
no, I'm, it does because feel like, yeah. Yes, it totally because you're pulling out moisture from the top first, so that's where the salt touches.
So just for the
surface contact,
just for the audience. I'm sorry, I just gotta go ahead and break off from the conversation just for a minute. But barbecue family, I'm sitting down with Russell Savage, Pico de Gringo on Instagram. I'm sitting down with. I'm sorry, Bubba, I'm horrible with names.
No. David Del Rio Gutierrez on Instagram, Food Sans Gray.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. I mean, we're having a fabulous conversation right now. I'm loving where this is going, and it just with both of y'all's background within food in general, it's amazing to be able to sit down and have a conversation about food and breaking down a certain subject. I don't have a culinary background whatsoever, but for both of y'all to have gone to, Johnson and Wales?
Mm-hmm.
Johnson and Wales, Denver campus, unfortunately closed right now.
I think it's closed indefinitely.
Closed indefinitely, yeah. But hey,
R.I.P.
largest vegan banana split.
That's right. Record. That's right.
We did that, or I didn't do it, but while I
it was in a... In college, or if you go to culinary school there and decide to get a bachelor's after, you can either go into food service management or nutrition.
Yeah.
And this largest banana split was made in a nutrition lab called Designing Healthy Desserts, where you take classic desserts and try to make them healthier and adapt them to different diets and stuff. And they just decided to do a vegan banana split, and I don't know how big it was. It was very so big. It was probably like 30 feet long. And
yeah.
Hundreds of scoops of ice cream, and
it was good too. The flavors were great.
Yeah, it's really good. I think vegan ice cream is, if you're using cashew milk or coconut milk, you get that satisfaction from the richness without the dairy.
Yeah, and it really hits. Like, what really? I'm a skeptic of this. I'm not like a huge like oh vegan. Like I do enjoy vegan stuff or vegetarian stuff, but like not for the premise of it being vegan. But it's right. Just like. It's good sometimes if you do it right. And there are so many people nowadays as we adapt in culture that have intolerances such as lactose or gluten or peanuts, stuff like that. It's just, it goes with how we are evolving. But to be able to make good quality vegan ice cream, like, oh, you have so many lactose intolerant people. Like, I swear to you, like, half the girls I know are lactose intolerant. And then my dad, like, dude, feed him pizza does not go well. Like,
what?
Yeah, so, like, lactose, we're not supposed to do it. Even, like, if you look at studies of, like... Oh,
I think Joe Rogan talked
yeah, about like, that. So if you look at studies of, like, Asian culture, they don't have as much lactose. In their past,
right.
And a lot of them are lactose intolerant because it's not technically something we're supposed to be eating, but it's so good. Who doesn't like some cheese?
Mm-hmm.
God, I love me some cheese.
Yeah,
it's cheese awesome. Making is.
It's not the best for all of us, but
no,
it's awesome.
I feel like cheese making is. Not in a way. I don't know if it's like barbecue, but it's such a process. I feel like it takes years to fully, not even fully understand it, but just get a grip of it.
I mean,
and all those bacteria. And,
I mean, in a sense, like look at wine.
Yeah. Oh man.
I mean, wine. You gotta. I mean, the grapes has to be like the vine has to be like 10 years.
Yeah,
11, quality, 15
for quality. Yeah.
Years old.
Because what you do is you're building nutrients. Your vines are on a certain terroir, a certain like soil. Oh,
fancy.
And they pull out the nutrients and the flavors, right?
Right.
And so if you think about it, you have a baby vine, it's not gonna be able to pull out the same kind of flavors and deep like complexity that you want. And so that's why age makes it better. Just like cheese. Age makes it better.
Mm.
Or just like if you make a good barbecue, like time makes it better. If you think about it, it's all about time.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of people, they fail. with food and stuff, they don't take the time. They don't build the complexity.
So if you were to think about it, if a place could be subpar, but the overall quality, like the consistency that they have over and over and over and over, like at any time, if there was a restaurant within Dallas that you can go to where you're like, it's going to taste exactly the same every time, would you rather go there? Or would you rather go to a place that is like, it's more expensive, but like the, you know for a fact that every ingredient was like flown in that morning. It was like super, super fresh, super, super delicious, like every time.
I think...
what would you do?
I think Uchi's a combination of...
I was just about to say
Uchi. Consistent quality.
Yeah.
Obviously, the quality is great there, but the consistency is there too, so it's the best of both worlds, as well as also Tay-Tay. I think they call it like Tay-Tay Robata Bar in Knox Henderson in Dallas. That place is incredible. Incredible. They have whole grilled fish. They have octopus, sea urchin. And every time I've been there, it's always been consistently good.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Those are Uchi. I just went there for the first time a month ago. I'm new to Dallas, so I'm exploring. And Uchi is amazing. The only thing that I would say about that is not necessarily flown in. Like, take advantage of your local stuff. That's something that, like, talk to your local farmers. Talk to your, like, look at the local gardens, what grows in your area.
Yeah.
Because that is going to be optimal thing to use. You know, so, like, don't fly something in if you can go and get something of better quality, cheaper, near you.
It's tough, though, with Japanese food. I mean,
Japanese food,
seafood, like, heavy.
Well, if you're doing seafood.
Yeah.
But you take seafood and... You make it regional.
I mean, especially with it being in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Dallas is what? How close to the ocean is Dallas? I mean, like
5 hours from the Gulf.
But that's the Gulf.
Yeah,
it's different.
I mean, that's different quality. It's different though, stuff. But, I mean,
it's not the quality. It's just like it's
maybe different. If you had great shrimp or something up coming from the Gulf. You know, I mean,
yeah, it's or a crab. Different thing.
Funny story about that side little tangent thing. I went fishing in the Gulf last year. And we'd fish actually right near the shrimp boats, because where all that shrimp is, that's, you know, fish food.
The bait.
So there were like porpoises swimming all around there eating shrimp, and we were catching fish that were eating the shrimp, and it was just a great little.
That's awesome.
Little balance.
Tell me,
it's pretty
cool.
Tell
me you didn't catch and release. Like you caught some fish and you kept it.
Unfortunately, we did catch and release. It was the law. We were over 30 miles out when we were actually catching fish, and that is federal waters, and at the time we were doing that, we weren't allowed to keep it, unfortunately.
That's horrible. Could you imagine?
But Gulf snapper is amazing raw, in particular, and like ceviche.
Oh.
My dream is to like catch one of those giant snappers and have a little thing of white rice and some soy sauce and wasabi and slice it real thin and do snapper sashimi right on the boat.
Dude,
that's
amazing.
That's
why you go prepared.
That's right.
Like,
those are the moments. Those are the moments that I live for.
Have Russell Savage on hand on the boat.
No, you don't need anyone. You just need a raw. There's just, no
just bite into that fish. Don't even skin it. Just
rely on the freshness of the seafood. You really don't have to do much precious. When the ingredients are that good.
No, you did not. Just do a Lord of the Rings impression. I love Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings and Red Snapper.
Yes.
But,
that's the way to enjoy food. I mean, if you can get it that fresh, you don't have to do anything. I mean, you don't have to cook it.
Different. It's different. You know, one of my greatest dreams, which is a weird dream, but like, one time I watched a documentary and they were, it was, I think it was like Andrew Zimmern. If you know Andrew Zimmern.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the guy that would eat duck eggs.
Right, eat everything, man. Dude, duck eggs are great.
I love duck eggs.
I mean, really? I worked at a restaurant that made a duck egg. I would poach the duck egg, and then you cool it down. It's a beautiful poached duck egg.
With
cool
a down. Fully formed fetus.
No, that's different.
We used to
put it in a mushroom salad, and the middle is still beautiful yolk just running out.
Oh, well, that's different. And I was thinking of the gnarly stuff.
Put in panko and fry that, and you cut that, and you get fried egg with the yolk running out, and it's
like an over easy.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yes.
That sounds good.
Flows out, and you got some mushroom that you'll dehydrated for a bit, and then you're rehydrated but with some sherry and mushroom stock, and so you cook that and put a little butter in there, and it would make this amazing mushroom salad.
So when are we having this? When are you making it?
I'll make it for us. we'll do this. Yeah,
that sounds awesome.
It was amazing.
The thing that you're bringing up, Drew, I think they call it balut.
Maybe
it's like
a idea.
I think that's what it's called.
It's a duck egg with
a that so bad.
With like a
really?
Duck fetus in it.
That. Yeah, eat everything you can, man. Just shove it in your mouth. Like, just eat it.
What?
No, I think it'd be interesting.
Could you imagine the texture of that?
Yeah, you get
like
feathers
mushy,
and bones.
Feathery.
Like, I wouldn't
crunchy.
Think it was mushy. It's like crunchy and like soft.
It's a very intimidating food, regardless of.
That's
the outlook on eating everything. Yeah. I think eating a duck egg with a baby duck in it is.
I got it. That's the next.
I would definitely try it, but I think they eat it with. I could be very wrong on this, but they eat it with like a fish sauce, like the Thai nam prick. It's like a Thai.
Yeah, oh,
I probably
so.
Butcher that Thai chili lime juice fish sauce. Sort
I have
of thing.
No idea.
And they
I
scoop that on top,
it.
And they
I'm
eat
not
it.
Lie.
You know what? That's gonna be the next big thing.
I don't know. Smoked fetal duck egg.
Fish sauce is so good on so many things.
Oh, yeah. Fish sauce is great. That's
God.
Natural MSG.
Yeah.
So, Andrew Zimmern stabbing a cow, a wild cow in Africa, drinking the blood. And that's a dream.
Jeez.
That's...
To drink warm cow's blood right out of there. Have you drank like
warm milk? I don't
know.
No,
but it's like...
Like, I could
like
imagine it's so...
Have you had a blood sausage?
Yeah, I've had blood sausage.
Well, yeah.
Blood sausage is so good, and it has so many nutrients and, like, minerals, and you can taste...
Like, very irony.
Yeah. It's
warm.
Very...
You gotta... You gotta add spices and vinegar and stuff if you like to combat that
But
minerally...
If you're stabbing...
Well, no, but I think it's different. I think if you're drinking it fresh from the animal...
You just enjoy
it. There's
what
no,
it is.
There's
yeah.
no.
You just enjoy
the blood.
It.
The blood doesn't have time to coagulate, so it just goes down smooth like a warm beverage.
Well, that's what
I think. I think it's as much of a cultural thing as it is a culinary thing. I don't know.
Golly.
I do remember that episode though. I think Anthony Bourdain in his No Reservations show did that too. Boy, that is crazy.
I'd
become too emotionally attached to the. The cow. I don't know if I could mentally get over that.
That's the sprinkles.
Yeah. Talking about, dude, emotionally attached and oh man, my father is gonna kill me for this, but like, so my grandfather raised rabbits for food.
Yeah.
It's in Mexico. I'm from Mexico. My family's from Mexico. Raised rabbits for food, but he would get too attached to them, and so he wouldn't let my father get attached to the rabbits. Because then he would tell my father, all right, we have to kill one for food. You know, like we're going to make a rabbit stew or whatever.
Yeah.
Go ahead and kill number three or whatever. And my dad's like, he took care of the rabbit. And you have rabbit stew that night. You know?
Love
but like
rabbit.
You can totally get attached to it. Like my grandfather would get attached. So he knew it's like, oh, don't let him get attached because we'll never have rabbit. You know?
I think... If I just had a pet pig, I'd have trouble eating pork selfishly.
Yes. Oh my god.
You have to to distance yourself from that
you
to be able to enjoy it.
Them.
That's tough.
You feed them, give them water. You don't name them.
Yeah, you have to strictly business.
I mean, I growing up, I never experienced that whatsoever. But I mean, my mom, if I'm wrong, she'll totally correct me on this. But my mom told me that she experienced that before with a steer.
Yeah.
You know, and just you going out there, you giving that steer a carrot every day. You know, you being a kid, and you kind of build a connection with that animal, and then next thing you know, it's like, wow, this burger tastes really, really good. And your, you know, grandfather's telling you, hey, you know Bessie? Well, yeah, she's great. Well, she tastes good too. Like, you gotta just go,
oh,
what?
God.
Oh my Lord.
That's rough. Yeah, yeah, but
I mean,
but that's what it, if you think about it, isn't it better that you gave them a good life and you cared for them and you took care of them?
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
That's absolutely something that, like, man, when I worked in, we talked about this, but I worked in New York, and we had a dairy partner for my business. Hmm. They were called Roniebrook. No, they're still around. They're amazing. Some of the best butter you'll have, some of the best milk. And they took care of their cows so much. They had heated pads for them to sleep on. They each were named. Like, they took so much care of them. And the product that came out, because you just care for someone. And, yeah, you are going to, oh, you need to be milked. Let's milk you and get some great products. You know, but you took care of them.
Yeah.
And if you look at it, us being at the top of the food chain, like, if you're able to create compassionate caring for the animals like that, then you're able to create a better product, and you create a better life for them. It's something that if you've never read, like, do you know who Dan Barber is?
Yeah. No, I personally don't.
Oh, man. Dan Barber wrote a great book called The Third Plate, and he runs a restaurant/farm. In upstate New York, Blue Hill, I believe.
I'll have to go check him out on Instagram or something.
Yeah, amazing. And he has, like, people come and, like, do amazing cool stuff at his at Blue Hill every couple weeks. They're, like, resident chefs. It's awesome. But one of the things about Third Plate is it talks about the quality that you make. So there's a story about foie gras. You know foie gras, and there's a bad reputation for it.
Like, yeah, look. I don't get that.
And it's because they say, oh, you're force-feeding ducks and geese and all this stuff. And no, it doesn't hurt them, but it doesn't make them live, like, the most comfortable life, right?
Right.
And I love foie gras. Amazing. I think it's great. Have you
so rich.
So rich.
Yeah,
amazing.
It really is.
But he talks about this farmer in Spain who has these fields with these, like, pigs and walnuts and acorns, or, like, acorns, and the diet is perfect for these geese. Mm. And so they're always there, and they just stay there, and they choose to be there because it's good food and all this. And at one point, he puts up this, like, bubble. And he's out there with a gas mask, and he's, like, comforting them. And they, like, gas them to sleep and make this foie gras, which is amazing. But because they leave...
Gas them to sleep?
Yeah, you sleep them. And then you...
Holy cow. Oh,
so that they're, like, they're comfortable when they die, you know?
That's nuts.
And he's hanging out with them, and he's like, all right, like, come here and, like, hang out. And they're eating walnuts, acorns, I mean, and all this stuff. That makes amazing food, amazing geese and all. And they had a great life. And it's like, all right, you had a great life. Now it's time to feed us. And
man, talk about, like, the care to the animal. I mean, to try to create the most perfect product.
Exactly.
But, oh, foie gras is really good. I really want some right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're not abusing of the animals. You're not putting them in these confined, like, tight spaces, which makes a lesser quality thing. So it's like, let's treat them better, get better quality stuff, and then we can enjoy it. And if you have to reduce your intake a little bit, that's okay, because it's higher quality.
Golly. You know, I heard actually over in Japan, it's a lot of myths, like when it comes to Wagyu.
Yes.
Beef, where they're like, oh, they massage them every day. They feed them beer every day. And I actually heard that's a myth. I actually saw something on the Discovery Channel. They're like, no, it's just the bloodline that the cattle over there that's had, and maybe the resources that are over there that the cattle are eating.
Yeah.
You know, it's a diet, man. It's a different,
like, the diet and the lifestyle.
Yeah.
But you're not massaging them every day. Yeah. Maybe they are, but
I heard that's a complete myth.
Yeah. I think that it's more about the quality that you take care of them with.
Yeah.
Yeah, you take care of what you're doing. If you're making a fruit or vegetable, you take care of that to make a better fruit or vegetable. Why would you not take care of a living thing?
Yeah.
To make a better quality product.
All right, you could say the same with wine, too.
Yeah. You take care of
your wine. I could say the same thing with barbecue.
Exactly.
Ooh.
You take care of your product or whatever you're doing in life in general.
I think barbecue's interesting because you really put in is whatever you put in, you're going to get out. If you're putting in a lot of effort, it's probably going to be pretty good. But if you're not, and temperature spikes and stuff like that, I think the product is compromised.
Maybe you're so having a
it's,
lot
it's,
of...
I think the difficult thing is sustaining that high attention to detail.
Yes.
On a day-to-day basis, which is what separates, I think, the good and not as good barbecue restaurants.
So the more inconsistencies that you have throughout a cook, maybe the product isn't going to yield as best as it should be. But if you're having a very consistent cook, and the more care that you have for the cook, whether you're spritzing every 30 minutes, maybe that's uncalled for. Maybe you're spritzing like every once in a while. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're having really good attention to detail on how the bark is building, making sure that there's not too much salt, making sure that there's not too much pepper. One thing that I noticed throughout barbecue cooks, especially on brisket, if it was over-seasoned, the bark would almost puff up like a burnt marshmallow. Mm-hmm. And if you touched the bark, it would just crumble.
Wow.
And so, to me, that told me right off the bat, there's too much salt. So the salt, you know, needs to melt down. So we would go through and spritz it pretty heavily. Maybe we'd do it every 30 minutes after that point that we noticed it. There was even a time that I noticed there wasn't enough black pepper on the brisket. And the brisket had already been on the pit for maybe 4.5 hours. And we were just kind of like, do we even bother adding more black pepper to the brisket now that the bark is starting to form? Would the sweating of the brisket when it's rendering down the fat, would it wash away the black pepper? I don't know. We just kind of like, you know what? Like, let's go ahead and try it. Like, screw it. Like, what do we have to lose? We either have a subpar product or maybe we're able to recover from that. And, I mean, honestly, at the end of the day, when we added the black pepper at the 4.5 hour mark, I couldn't tell a difference. It was actually really, really good. I was pretty surprised.
For me, myself, I think there's certain things I do in barbecue that maybe it's an unnecessary step, but it almost keeps me from being lazy. Like certain rotations and stuff. Sometimes I just do them just to keep myself busy, if that makes sense. And yeah,
on top of it.
It just keeps me doing things and on top of it because I feel like if I'm not doing anything, it's not going to turn out as well. And then I have the tendency to maybe just slack off and not do something. But
yeah.
With that said, though, that I've learned over the years, whether it's cooking or barbecue or baking bread, the harder way is not always the better way. So some chef instructors in college would try to steer us, being like, you have to get it done this way. You have to peel the carrots when you put them in a stock. You have to do this, you have to do that, but really, like,
people cares when you put them in a sauce.
Yeah.
You're just going to strain those babies out anyway.
I know. But it's all about, like,
I've never heard of that.
Clarity in the broth.
Peel the carrots for other things. There are so many good things you can peel carrots for. But for a stock, I feel like, okay.
No, I don't do it. I just think it's a.
Is it one of those things that's kind of pointless? Like, why even bother doing
it? Yeah, I think so. But I think it teaches this. I think,
but it's not a big enough effect that it matters. If you're going to use the stock, you're going to use it for one or two things. And so you're either going to use it to fortify something and make something more tasty.
Enhance flavor.
And at that point, I think that sometimes the rustic part of it is.
It's more about the discipline of, like, doing things a certain way and doing them that way because that's what they say. And
right.
It does preach discipline and other
–
it goes beyond that. It's like, we're doing it this way because this is the – we've been taught this is the right way to do it. And I guess technically peeling carrots before putting them into a stock is the right way to do it. But I think being able to think, you know, outside the box is – equally as important as it is to stick to tradition.
Well, I think that also you just have kind of have to look at it and be like, try them both.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a good idea, or if you have an idea, try it.
Hmm.
Right?
Try to see what the difference is.
You just experiment. You try it one way and try it a different way. And you try them each, and you take notes, and you're like, all right, this is what I got with this. And then you do the other way, and you try it, and you're like, write notes, this is what I did, got with this.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
For some reason, an idea popped up in my mind is, should we cook a brisket that's just kosher salt, black pepper, and then cook another brisket that has kosher salt, black pepper, and Lowry's, and see if there's a real difference in it?
Yeah, totally.
I think there would because be a real difference. Because
apparently that's a rave right now. Like everyone,
I don't think
the secret ingredient.
I think that what's popping up right now is
tallow too.
No, bigger than that is now there's a bunch of barbecue guys that are really really talented that are making these YouTube videos that are revealing things that
were never revealed.
Because. Prior, you know, with the exception of maybe Aaron Franklin, no one was working in barbecue restaurants or had that barbecue restaurant experience and making videos. So now they're sharing stuff that they've either learned at the restaurants or learned from, you know, trial and error and stuff. But it's totally changing the way people are now cooking brisket.
For sure.
Johnny, Joe Yim.
Chud.
Chud, Bradley. Who else? I think there's some more. I don't know. Maybe not. Those are the three I'd say that are. If you want to learn barbecue or you don't have access to going to like great restaurants or working at a restaurant, those guys make pretty good, very good videos, actually. Not pretty good.
Repeat those names real quick.
Joe Yim, Brad Robinson, Chud's Barbecue, and then Johnny White, who goes by Jerby.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Those guys are, if you want to learn how to like trim a brisket, I think they all have trimming videos.
I'd say Joe Yim's is the best. But
man,
they're all virtually the same.
Yeah.
The end result's
all good.
But I think the way that it's, that Joe comes across in the video, it's more instructional.
Mm-hmm. I think my take on it, like Joe has the teaching background, he's so methodical and really kind of just teaches it very organized sort of way. And Johnny likes to break what I've learned recently after watching some of his videos, just breaking myths. You don't have to use mustard as a slather. You don't have to use this. You can do it this way. You can cold smoke for longer than an hour. You can do this. You can do that. And Brad's or Chud's Barbecue, man, that guy. He does so many different things with his Chud boxes. He's like an engineer. He's a chef. He does all these different things.
Yeah, it's nuts.
And he's turned it into a business, which is really, really cool.
You know,
cool.
The only thing that he's missing is a podcast.
If I know, right?
I totally listen to it all the time.
So I really maybe, wouldn't maybe be surprised if it came.
Tug him into doing this podcast.
I would love that.
That's how we do that.
That would be amazing. Yes. And I totally would have him on the show. And in fact, there's one more mic that I could add to this if he was to come into this conversation. But, you know, when I think about barbecue at the end of the day, where it's going, I think there are so many places out there that are almost copycatting where they're trying to do the traditional style of barbecue. And personally, I feel that the way barbecue is going to evolve is through chefs and through people that have gone through culinary school or people that are more open to finessing barbecue and having more attentive to detail to it. Being more of a trendsetter, not a trend follower, where you know that you can make a certain product that is trending at the time and be able to sell it. More plating style instead of it being like trays of meat all the time and having your typical sides, the green beans, the potato salad, the mac and cheese, banana pudding. I can expect that from every single barbecue joint that I go to in Texas. Do I think that it's the wrong thing to do? No. If you can execute a product and it be really, really good, by all means, do it. But if you want to grow and want to be different from everybody else, Joe Yim talks about sides all the time. Russell and you and I have talked about sides and maybe like a different protein that could set you apart from other barbecue joints. But really, ultimately, in the end, if you think about it, if you can incorporate the smoker as another tool within the kitchen instead of it just being a grill or a flat top, I think the possibilities are endless.
What do you think? Yeah, I agree. And I think that one of the things that you said that really captivates me, it's finesse.
Yeah.
What you're doing is you're finessing it. And whenever you're looking to barbecue anything, whenever you're looking to cook anything, you're grabbing the best product that you can.
Absolutely.
And so you already had the best product. Why not finesse it and make it the best that you can make it? You know, and taking it to the next level. If you stick with what you keep doing, you may say that if it ain't broke,
don't fix it.
But that's if you want.
If you could soup that thing up,
you're gonna stay stagnant. You're not gonna grow.
No cap.
So yeah, you need to you need to have a mindset of growth. Like, what can I do?
What's going to separate you from everybody else, especially within Texas? What would you say?
I think.
What would you say? What could separate you?
I think, I don't know, bringing the sides are a big thing. And
huge.
Sides are huge.
I don't know. I think if you're opening. Yeah.
Why?
I think if you're opening a traditional style Texas barbecue joint in Texas right now, I think it'll work. If it's in the right area, if it's in a place that's kind of a barbecue desert.
Desert, I love that.
But I think if you're looking to
say
open...
Say you're in Austin.
I think you just... It depends who's opening it. Like, if it's a bunch of, like, famous pit guys, I think they're going to have no problem. But if it's just a random guy that... Or someone that isn't really known in the barbecue community...
Yeah.
He may struggle if he's just doing traditional stuff. But with that said, I think if you open a traditional barbecue place and really know what you're doing in a different state, that alone is untraditional because all the barbecue there most likely isn't going to be like that, or if there's any barbecue at all there.
Yeah. It's not going to be in the right conditions either.
Right.
There's so much good stuff here in Texas. I think the way to I guess I would just expand to a different state if I were to open a barbecue restaurant, but we already talked about this. I probably wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
It's, I have mad respect for everyone that does do it. Whether it be a top 50 barbecue place or a mom and pop shop. You know, that's somewhere
traditional
else.
That you're talking about.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, I think any type of barbecue place would be tough to open just because of the logistics. And
what have you innovated?
I think just opening a restaurant in general doesn't appeal to me too much. Mm-hmm. But I say that now. I'm sure a couple years ago I would have said.
What about creating a concept with other fellows who care about the craft? You create a concept, and it's not like.
I mean, it would definitely be fun to create a concept.
Yeah. That's
because I think my imagination would go wild. But I don't know. I think I don't know what my future holds. I think that's just a too.
I mean, for me, like if I was, call me bold or brash or whatever you want to call it, but I mean, I want to make my mark. You know, I mean, to me, barbecue food in general is something that I love to do every single day. If this is my profession, I'm going to fucking be badass at it.
Oh, yeah.
If you're not striving for that within what you love to do, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So when we talk about time,
that's what it is.
When we talk about trying to make food or a kind of food better in general, you got to be able to. You'll have the people that are like, "That's not old school barbecue. You can't do that." But then you'll have other people that are saying, "New school barbecue. This is totally different." Whether it's just smoking it or cooking product on a Santa Maria grill, you're using fire as a mm-hmm. concept of your art.
Old school and new school kind of confuse me because it seems that like old school would be like an offset, right? Like just using fire, and which it is, I guess. Like
just using just old using, German brick pits.
No, yeah, that, but like a Moberg pit or like a decommissioned propane tank converted into a smoker. Seems very old school to me, but I feel like the new school places are the ones that use that, and the old school places kind of use the, I guess from what I've known, like the rotisseries, which could be totally wrong, and they definitely have, there's a place in Houston that does like those brick pits. I think it's called, actually, I don't know what it's called. Pizzatolas? I think it's called Pizzatolas. I think it's the only brick operating restaurant with a brick pit in Houston. Well, which seems really cool to cook on, actually. Because it's almost like a, kind of like a, I guess it would be like a decommissioned propane tank, but instead of the tank, it's bricks. So, same sort of concept. But I know in Lockhart they have things like that. But, yeah, I don't know where I was going with that.
No, you good. You have a huge background in wine. I don't know much about pairing wine or knowing wine at all, but I know barbecue. But when it comes to wine, you know, Mark and Mike Black talked about pairing wines with barbecue and just being able to taste the different grapes into different styles within wine. To me, a red wine is a red wine. A Merlot is a Merlot. Like a white is a white. Mm-hmm. But when you're breaking down the, you know, what could be the next, if you're just a wino, what could be the next best thing at that? If you're in the wine business, I mean, well, you're
the beauty. Yeah, so I'm a sommelier. So I went to Germany and I studied there. I just did educational, so I right. didn't do practical. But I have a level 2, which is good, you know. Well, it's really level 3 where you hit the next ride.
Yeah.
But, like, I wanted it to be something that I understood as somebody who loves about food and stuff like that. And I would love to – I will continue to study it and grow with it. But something beautiful about wine and barbecue is that barbecue – if you actually know and care about barbecue, it's – it has several dimensions, And as you taste more of it and as you eat more of it, you get different layers and you're able to appreciate different things about it. You know, you can taste the smoke that it had, the amount,
the saltiness, the salt, the pepper,
everything, the pepper. You can taste the care. And that's why being a barbecue pit master is so hard. You know, it's not, you can't pick it up in one day. You can't pick it up in 6 weeks, months, a year, you know.
Yeah.
It takes time because you have to care about it and you have to be able to notice little things about it. And that's the same thing with wine. And that's where they pair so well because you have so many different layers of flavor in barbecue. You have the fat that cuts through. You have salty, smoky, some sweet, all these different flavors. And depending on the barbecue and how you made it or whatever the process was, it's going to affect the way it interacts with your wine. You know, it's going to cut in a different way. And so wines, this is my suggestion for people who don't know wine a lot. Like, number one, go and talk to someone who knows about wine. But number two, if you're doing barbecue, of course, you're going to do something probably red-wise. So you have your Merlots, Pinot Noirs, all these different, like, wines, you know. But take a taste test. Grab two or three different wines. So maybe grab a Hermitage, maybe you grab a colder Loire red, you know, maybe you grab something like just a normal Pinot or a Merlot or whatever, and you taste it with your barbecue and you're going to be able to taste the difference. And you do taste tests, just like you're doing with barbecue. You taste different briskets or you taste different things. Taste the different wines with the barbecue and see where your palate leads you. Because that's what it's about, you know, with food especially. It's like you're going to search for what fits your palate, you know, regardless of what everybody else says. It's what fits your palate, and you grow it from there.
Mm.
I like Julia Child's quote, not word for word, but she says, "I love cooking with wine. Sometimes I'll even add it to the food."
Exactly.
That's a good quote.
Well, gentlemen, I've really enjoyed this podcast with y'all and being able to sit down. And we had a great time tonight. We broke some bread. We ate at Loro, had a couple of cocktails. And being able to just sit down and talk food with y'all is a blessing in itself. Thank you so much, guys. I really appreciate you being a part of the show.
Cheers, everyone.
Cheers. It was wonderful.
Cheers.
Let's do it again.
Well, thank you, barbecue family, for listening. Again, more episodes to come. And definitely we'll have another podcast like this for sure. You guys have a wonderful night. Bye-bye.